Hello, and welcome to the Afro Reads podcast with your hosts,
Amara
and Ugochi.
Afro Reads is a book review podcast that was created out of our shared love for reading African fiction books.
We talk through its themes and try to tie its key messages to our African heritage, culture, and contemporary issues.
We invite you to turn the page and let's begin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the 8th episode of Afro Reads podcast. My name is Amara, and I am joined by my co-host, Ugochi. Today, we take you to the shores of Liberia, and we have a special guest with us today. But before that, I will introduce the book we are about to review. So it's The House at Sugar Beach by Helene Cooper. And our special guest today is Sieta May Stubblefield. She wears a lot of hats. She is an African storyteller, a proud African storyteller, a playwright. She runs a book club and is also a motivational speaker. I'll leave it to our guest to say a few words about herself. Sieta May, so in a few words, tell us about yourself and, for instance, what gets you out of bed in the morning?
Okay, well, I appreciate the motivational speaker shout out. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I consider myself a wife and a mother, and definitely a Liberian playwright. To me, it's so important. What gets me out of bed in the morning is really telling our stories. I think for us as West Africans, as Africans, it's so important that we share our stories, good, bad, and ugly, that we share with others. There's so much inspiration in there for ourselves, for our children, and for people who we may not even know. It's so important to me that we as Africans, that we share our stories and tell it. So that gets me up and moving in the morning.
Thank you very much, Sia, to me. That sums up what we are also trying to do at Afro Reads podcast, which is like shed more light on African stories so that more people are just aware of what's going on. And it's not all about one-sided stories that have been the narrative for a long time.
Yes.
All right. So we're going to skip to current events. Usually in this segment of the podcast, we discuss news articles or just news stories that have come up and are kind of interesting to share. Sieta May, as our guest, will start from you. Is there anything this week with regards to global development or Africa that really piqued your interest this week?
Nothing really stands out to me. I mean, I guess I will say for me, with things that are happening in Afghanistan, I can't help but, for me being a refugee, I can relate to just turmoil that comes completely out of your control, and all of a sudden your life has changed overnight. And I don't know if most people can relate to things like that, but I think for me, being Liberian with the war, it's easy to relate that one minute you're doing something, you're making plans for next week, and in a heartbeat your entire life has changed. It's completely different, you know? So I think that's something that has just been on my heart. You know, I understand being how things can change overnight, literally, you know? So that's probably the one thing that stands out for me. You know, I can't think of anything else, but I know that has been on my heart of late, you know, just being a refugee. I understand.
And it's also quite relevant to our topic of discussion. So you've just mentioned that you've had a similar experience as a refugee. So it'd be interesting to probe you a bit further along the podcast. But Ugochi, I know we were discussing this week about the situation in Afghanistan, and I know you wanted to also bring it up as a current event for you.
Yeah, I did some background research just to see how we got to this point, like with the creation of the Taliban and everything.
Yeah.
So I learned that Kabul in 1979 became under the Soviet control. So there was war in villages that eventually reached Kabul, and terrorist attacks from like Islamic extremists. I don't want to say Islamic extremist groups at that time. They just wanted to fight off communism. That's how they rose. That's, I guess, the rise of Islamic politics. They were trying to get rid of the Soviet occupation. and they started doing terrorist attacks just to weaken the government. Many of these refugees relocate to Pakistan. And there's actually Osama bin Laden, who, and he's from Saudi Arabia. He decides mm-hmm. to unite these types of refugees mm-hmm. around the world in Pakistan. And that's how he created the Taliban.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I guess the Taliban was created under, I don't know if it's good pretenses or bad. They really wanted this, the Russians out. Mm-hmm. And that eventually happened. I'm not sure what year that was. They eventually got the Russians out. And so people were happy because they're mm-hmm. getting the country back.
Yeah. But
of course, with some extremist groups, you have some crazy people.
Yeah.
So it quickly became violent again. And people, I guess, within the Taliban, they started fighting each other. Mm-hmm. Which is common. As we've read all these books, it's common for these rebel groups to start fighting each other. And then civilians are the ones who get hurt. That's what happened.
I think it's crazy because, you know, last 2 weeks we're talking about South Sudan and I was like, no, this is absolutely like the worst place, you know, the worst period of time in history for anyone living in South Sudan. And we are now back to Afghanistan. And I'm like, I wonder if there's anyone in Afghanistan like willing to live there under the Taliban, because it seems like the whole country is emptying out. Like every day you hear about evacuation plans from different countries. So
the way people are leaving, I mean, people would rather risk their life. I'd rather die trying. I mean, you know, that kind of, for someone to get to that point where it's like, I would rather die trying to leave than to stay, you know, that urge to say, I have to get out of here. You know, that's something that is hard to not feel for that, you know, to have something in your heart that says, well, regardless of what your political background may be, but just the idea, like, I'm not going to stay here and take a chance. I have to get out of here, you know? Yeah. So.
Yeah. And as you said, their whole world changes. You go from having some kind of social status in your country to living like a refugee. I don't have personal experience like being of refugee status, but my mom, who is half Trinidadian, during the civil war, the Biafran civil war, like, again, they went from like a very comfortable state to Trinidad because they had to travel to Trinidad to kind of escape the war. And she was like, as soon as you enter, they just treat you like you're coming to beg or something. And that's the status you have. Obviously, they went back 3 years later. But I'm not directly there. But the way my mom describes it, it seems like that's what you've just said.
Yeah.
So my own topic this week, that is also loosely based on what we're speaking about today, is Beyonce modeling the Tiffany diamond. Like 120 something carats. I've never known what that really means, but the diamond was excavated in the 1800s in a colonial period in British history in South Africa. I think the Kimberley Mines.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the Kimberley Mines. And I remember when I opened social media like 4 or 5 days ago, like there was a whole spread of Beyonce, like everybody's post. And I was like, what's going on? And then I saw the yellow diamond on her neck and I was like, this is so pretty. And obviously Jay-Z. So there was a whole Black Power movement. And then when I now read the story about it being a Tiffany diamond, even without knowing anything about its history, I was like, oh my God, like, this is not going to end well. And then I started reading about it. And she's facing quite a lot of backlash. And, you know, I won't say rightly so, but I guess it's just one of those mismatched or just misfired campaigns. Like, you bring a Black woman to model, basically, either it's a blood diamond, I'm not sure, allegedly a blood diamond, or at least it wasn't gotten in the most political corrected way, considering like it was in the British colonial times and you know these miners were basically slaves. For 100 and something years, no Black person has ever modeled it. She's like the first Black person. You're now putting it on her when most of the people that would see it would probably not afford to buy a diamond or something.
Right.
The whole thing is just so bizarre. Like, I was wondering, you know, these questions were not asked. But yeah, that was very interesting.
It also begs the question, like, what is power? What do you see as power? Do you see it as wearing that kind of diamond?
Right.
And people are looking at you and like, oh, wow, this person is so powerful, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think, wonder what was going through her mind when she accepted this. I don't know.
And, you know, maybe because, I mean, I know she has, at her heart, she has celebrated a lot of things just with culture. And seem to have a love for it. Sometimes people forget that, you know, that you just have to do your history because sometimes the things you celebrate, you don't know the backstory behind things sometimes, you know, until you actually research it, you know, to learn that, yes, yeah, diamonds, but to go see blood diamonds and to know the history and how is there's actually a really bad backstory behind diamonds and things like that. It's not quite... You know, I mean, I hear what her intent was, but sometimes it's like we do the research to see the celebration may not be as much as what you thought it was, you know?
So. Yeah, but Beyonce is somebody in the industry that always tries to be politically correct. Like during the halftime for that famous sporting season you guys have in America, I don't remember. What's it?
Super Bowl.
She did the whole Black Panther thing, and I hear like when she comes for photo sessions or like she's shooting something, it's all about the Black power. She makes sure she has Black photographers, and then her last album was all about African celebrating African. So I'm wondering, didn't someone on her team say, because as I said, it didn't take me doing any historical search. As soon as I saw Tiffany Diamonds 1800, I was like, no, this is not going to end well. So
yeah, I know.
It's just very interesting. The only thing,
you know what? I can't help to think that this is like a play on, I guess, her audience. Like, you've gone all these years with having... I guess Caucasian models. And as people have become more aware now, you can't necessarily use those same models to advertise that diamond. So you're gonna advertise it as, oh, first Black woman to wear and to expect to be in awe.
So that was their point. They actually targeted Beyonce, but obviously in the positiveness of trying to bring young people back to buying Tiffany diamonds and stuff. But yeah, it's just, I don't know, but it's just not going well. But on the flip side, I hear that a good amount of money, I think up to $2 million or more, is being raised from that to help with scholarships for disadvantaged youth. I'm not sure. I don't have full information of that.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, that's good. If the money is being raised for a cause that will help kids, you know, or young children, then that's hopefully that good will come out of all of this, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it could just be a backtracking mechanism, but that's not a bad thing.
I will say this, and I don't want to get into it too much because, I mean, we could all have deep opinions about this, but then sometimes people who may not be from back home, there's a certain romanticism about kings and queens and royalties and things like that. Yeah. And when you actually are from there and you live there, it's a different reality. You know, I mean, there are kings and queens in our own right, but it's not necessarily everyone diamonds, royalty.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the queens were probably circumcised.
There's real life things are happening. It's not just kings and queens. I mean, you know, we are great people. We're proud. You know, we have made great contributions. But I think sometimes people who may not read and get a full understanding of what's happening back home, it's easy to romanticize. You know, like everybody's royal, wearing gowns, and you know what I mean. I mean, you know, a lot of this from things in the media versus actually not just watching a movie, but actually knowing that when you're on the ground, it's not really about kings and queens and you know, diamonds and royalty and things like that. I mean, I think there's a certain romanticism for people when they think of back home. And when you actually get there and see life on the ground, it's not necessarily like that, you know.
Yeah,
so you have
yeah.
to do the research and ask the questions to really know what's happening, you know, that is not all romanticized, you know.
Mm-hmm. So. Just to say, Beyonce has also been criticized for that, especially on her last album, but I'm not going to go into that. but yeah, very thought-provoking discussions. And as I said, both topics, surprisingly or not, kind of leads on to what we are discussing it today regarding the book. So I'm just going to give a brief summary about the book for our listeners that didn't get a chance to read the book. I mean, we still encourage you to buy it, but yes, this 2-minute summary hopefully should do for now. So The House at Sugar Beach is a memoir written by Helene Cooper, who shares her experiences growing up in Liberia and eventually moving to the United States. Helene was born in Monrovia, Liberia in 1966, where her life was relatively favorable for her and her family. She was a descendant from elite families who founded Liberia, one of whom was Elijah Johnson, who was a freed African slave and was on the first ship that returned to Africa in 1820 carrying free slaves. Helene mentions that since many of the ships that carried free slaves entered Atlantic through the mouth of the Congo River, freed slaves were called Congo people, and natives, people who lived in Liberia prior to the freed slaves, were called country people. Helene and her family moved to Sugar Beach when she was about 7 years old. Sugar Beach is situated outside the capital of Monrovia. Although remote, their new home was said to be luxurious. It had about 22 rooms, a lot of service staff, and overlooked the ocean. Due to Helene's recurring nightmares of herdsmen and thieves, her mom soon found a living playmate called Eunice. Eunice was a country girl from the Bassa tribe. Very quickly, Eunice integrated into the family, becoming very close to Helene and her sister Marlene. It was explained that the Congo people had privilege in Liberia's society as they acquired wealth, land, access to education, and positions in the government. We also get a sense that Congo people may have exhibited a superiority complex through Helene's description of her grandmother, Mama Grand, who was described to have felt of higher class than the Lebanese or country people because she had a legacy from her founding fathers. It came as no surprise that the natives had built up anger from being treated like lower class citizens. In summary, 4% of Liberia's population owned 60% of its wealth. All that changed in April 14, 1979, where the students of University of Liberia protested this unbalanced phenomenon, which resulted in riots, looting, and 50 people dying due to the tear gas and government action. President at that time, William Tolbert, blamed the students, shut down the university, and suspended writ of habeas corpus and civil liberties. This further fueled tension and ultimately led to his assassination in his executive mansion by Samuel Doe and his native soldiers and rebels in April 1980. 14-year-old Helene described this period as the death of her childhood. Samuel Doe and his men began to execute those who formerly had some sort of power or held important positions, including Helene's uncle, Uncle Cecil. Soldiers came to Sugar Beach and gang raped Helene's mother. They had shot Helene's father in an attempt to extort him for money. The Congo people were no longer safe in Liberia, and Helene and her mother and her sister left soon after the coup to America, with her father joining them soon after. In America, Helene was now a refugee adjusting to her new life, as she no longer felt the privileges of being royalty in Liberia. As the wealthy were leaving Liberia, there was a steep decline in Liberia's economy, further exacerbated by a decade-long civil war spearheaded by Charles Taylor. Helene was focused on her future, on becoming a renowned journalist, and tried to mentally erase her affiliation with Liberia. While there was continuous unrest in Liberia, Helene would cover civil injustice and unrest in other parts of the world, including Mississippi, South Africa, and Iraq. It was during the war in Iraq where she almost lost her life. She had a revelation, finally coming to the realization that home was the only place she belonged. She ended up back in Liberia to find Eunice and to see what her house at Sugar Beach had become. Right, so that was a summary of the book. I'm sweating because I felt like I was talking for like... It's finally ended. All right, so Theatre May, this is basically your platform now. So the first question we have for you is, you left Liberia in the 1990s, like Helene, during the Civil War. Can you tell us a bit about your experience, contrasting the time you had in Liberia and the experience you had after leaving the country?
Yes. I think for me, the theme that keeps coming up with Liberia and even with the situation in Afghanistan is just fragility, how fragile life can be, that things change in a heartbeat. So in 1990, when we left Liberia, you know, we left Liberia in May. And I will probably say probably from maybe either November, December, the year before of 89, we had heard about Charles Taylor coming, you know, kind of coming down. Mm-hmm. We knew there were rebels and he was getting stronger, but nobody really paid attention to it. In fact, I think, you know, there was a movie out and sort of say, oh, Chucky coming, Chucky coming. I mean, it was almost a joke, you know, so we knew something was going to happen, but nobody imagined, you know, because life was for many people, life was good in Liberia. You know, you can have a nice home, you had a job, you know. It wasn't, you know, it was a good life. So you hear that this man is coming, he's coming. I don't think anyone really could understand the weight of what was going to happen, because nobody even foresaw something like that happened in Liberia. You know, it was known for being a pretty peaceful country. You know, everybody did their thing. You know, we had had a coup in 1980, but for the most part, you know, that seemed like something happened. We have moved past that. So I don't know. I don't think anyone saw what was about to happen to our country. Like I said, I remember in December, people were saying, oh, Charles Taylor coming, Chucky coming. But it wasn't anything that anybody thought their life was going to be turned inside out, you know?
Yeah.
So in May of 1990, at that time, it was almost like summer break for us in Liberia. So my uncle was going to dedicate his son. And so my mom decided for us to make a trip there. We packed two suitcases. We're just going to go there and come right back. Like I said, nobody foresaw anything change in Liberia. But when we went to New York for this dedication, that plane we took was next to the last plane that's going to leave Liberia. We didn't know that. We just boarded Liberia to go, you know, because there's no way my mom would have just packed two suitcases if she knew that was going to happen. We were going to really pack everything and make plans to leave, you know. So my mom, my sister, my brother, and I, my dad stayed back in Liberia. And so my mom left with us. And once we got to New York, we were supposed to stay for 2 weeks and come back, it became pretty clear that things were getting bad really fast. Mm-hmm. And so there was one more flight that left after we came, you know, and they said that was going to be the last flight. So all of a sudden, you know, my dad was still in Liberia. We still have plenty of family people. My mom's siblings were in Liberia. It just got really chaotic because you can't reach, you know, we couldn't call those people. We didn't really know what was happening. Wow, and so everything just broke loose after that. So my mom had to start pretty much a whole new life with us, you know, and the two suitcases, you know, we all understand. We didn't know where my dad would come. He eventually was able to make it out. He came later that year in about November. But it took him a long time to come out because it wasn't like now we can just pick up your cell phone and call people. You know, I mean, we had landline phones, but it wasn't one of those things that you could just call the person and say, hey, what's going on? You know, people were, it's almost like, just like you turn your world upside down. People are running for their lives. It's chaotic. People don't know what's happening. People scream, you know, fleeing. Things are upside down. You have to be careful. My dad worked for the government, so you have to be careful with your place of employment, because all of a sudden you consider the enemy overnight. You know, you went from maybe having a job where you worked, that was your job, you contributed to your family, to all of a sudden the job you have, because it's a job with the government, you all of a sudden you are the enemy, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a tough time. But as bad as it was for us, our story was nowhere near what other people went through. I mean, there were people who actually had to walk on foot to get a Monrovia to seek safety. And you got soldiers who killing people left and right all around you. You don't know if you could get shot. You don't know if you could get killed. So as inconvenienced as it was for us to come over here with two suitcases.
Yeah.
The stories I know for people I know personally, when they tell me their stories, I mean, it breaks your heart what people went through during the war, you know, and then some people are separated from the family for years, mothers from their children, you know, husbands and wives. It was a really tough time, you know, leaving Liberia and then resettling, because that was not something you plan for. You don't plan to leave your country.
Yeah.
You just have to figure things out. You don't know how long it'll be. I think initially most Liberians probably thought, okay, this is crazy. Everything is turned upside down, but in a couple of months, we'll be able to go back and figure this thing out. And then after a while, it's like, this is not something that is going to go away in a couple of months.
Permanent.
You know? That's, it's something permanent, but we didn't realize that at the beginning of it, you know.
So as a child, so how old were you in 1990?
I was 12. I was 12. No, actually, I just turned 13. So I was 13 in 1990.
But Helene seemed excited. Not excited, like, let me not say that. But in a way, she was finally getting her dream kind of to live in America. And did you have those feelings? Or were you just aware that your family is being separated, bad things are happening?
Mm-hmm.
Or as a child, were you like, okay, yeah.
I think for me, I really was enjoying my life in Liberia. I didn't want to leave Liberia. So at that point, 13 years old, you know, I had a good life. I had friends, you know, I even had a little boyfriend who was starting to talk to me. So from my point of view, I didn't want to leave Liberia. You know what I mean? I didn't want to leave Liberia. And even though this was America, America was great, it's almost like, you didn't want to leave. I mean, it's one thing if you pack up your stuff and say, I don't want to be in this country, I choose to leave the country, but you're forced to leave. You know what I mean? You don't have a chance to say goodbye to people. So I think from our perspective, and so that's where it gets tough. I mean, I think even for somebody who was maybe financially struggling, where maybe they weren't going through a good time in Liberia, just the fact that you had to leave there, you had no choice in the matter, even if your life was tough at the time. You know, there's so much unknown. You know, you don't know America. You don't know, you know, for a lot of people, it's like, you got to figure out your paperwork. How are you going to get educated? This is not a system you used to. There's a lot of things unknown. So even if your life was not going well in Liberia, there had to be a sense of, at least at that time, I think as you move further away from the war, maybe like 2-3 years, you know, from the war, you know, if you had a chance to come to America, things were really tough in Liberia. So most people would say, yes, get me out of here. I want to go to America. But when it first happened, there were so many things unknown that it was just a sense of chaos, because you didn't know what was going to happen. You couldn't, I mean, you know, most people at that time would love to come to America, come vacation, come shop, go back, you know, show your clothes to your friends and things like that.
Yeah.
You're in a situation where that was not the plan. You know what I mean? So from my perspective as a kid, it was not something that it was not something I was excited about initially. I think we grew to learn to accept and eventually appreciate the situation. But initially, it was not something that I embraced. And not to mention, when you come here to America from back home, people call you all kinds of things. You know, African booty scratcher.
I heard.
Trees, all those kind of things. And so, you know, you're already trying to get adjusted to a whole new society, a whole new culture. Then you got to deal with the fact that you got people calling you all kind of names, make you feel embarrassed for your culture. You know, maybe back home, all your friends, y'all could laugh, have fun and joke about things. You come on this side and people don't embrace you because it's a whole new set of groups, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, people used to joke that America, they call America as a great equalizer, because no matter how rich you were back home, you can come to America and be scrubbing pots, because all the status you had in Liberia, it went out the window. All of a sudden in America, maybe you don't have your paper straight. Maybe you had a lot of money back home, but because you don't have your paper straight, it's not you don't have the status you have back home. So that's a whole nother mental shift. And maybe back home, you're a government official, you have 3 cars, you have plenty of money. You come here to America, I mean, you didn't expect to be here. So it's not like you can just put the money in a bank account. I mean, you know, you don't have access to those things. So they call America the equalizer because you come on this side and things may not be as it was in your country, you know? So I know for me at that time, it was not a time for me. I wasn't excited about being here. I mean, eventually I came to appreciate the opportunities that were here, but initially I was not excited to be here because it wasn't my choice or my family's choice. And I didn't know where the rest of my family were back home. You know, we weren't in touch with them initially.
You said you were on one of the last planes out of Liberia.
Yeah.
Is that Charles Taylor like stopped planes from going out and coming in?
I think honestly, it was probably the U.S. where it's not safe. You know, they weren't going to be flying people there in that kind of situation. Mm-hmm. I think for some of the airlines, it was like, we don't know what's going to happen. We hear soldiers killing people. We hear fighting, all that kind of stuff. Because I think in 1980, for the coup, as bad as it was almost like, you know, people were, I mean, definitely, I'm not trying to minimize it. People were killed and hurt, but something happened overnight. You wake up in the morning, it's like, okay, this is a whole new system. You know, now there was certainly fear throughout the country that if you are connected with a former government, you could be killed. But I think we went from like a incident to being something across the whole, I mean, there was no one who can say they weren't affected by the 1990 war. Whereas maybe for 1980, people were affected, but it wasn't across the culture, across the society as it was in 1990. So I think for the planes, it was like, we're not, you know, I'm not sure how they arrived at that decision, but I just remember knowing people where they're like, we barely made this last flight. So, I mean, if the flight were on was not the flight before the last flight, it was maybe a few before, but there weren't too many planes going there. You know, you really had to try to get back into Liberia, you know, going through, you know, Freetown or some other way to get into it because people weren't, it just wasn't safe, you know.
Slide. So the follow-up question we had was based on our discussion, the social class for the Congo and country people, is there still like a difference? Like if someone says they're from the Bassa tribe, like would you, are they from a different social status as somebody that, I don't know, was a descendant of the freed slave? Or did Samuel Doe's 10-year reign kind of level the ground?
It's a good question. It's tough to answer because I think his reign changed a lot of things. Because before he got there, it was mostly, you know, ruled by people with, you know, American Liberian bloodline. So it was completely different. So his changed everything because it opened up some new opportunities to say, hey, just because my background is not American Liberian doesn't mean I can't enjoy and come forward and do some things. So I think that changed things a lot. I will say that it's tough because I think I have lived in America so long. I think my perspective might be different than people who actually stayed in Liberia throughout the time. I think that people, I'm not explaining it. It's like, even as it is now, living in Atlanta, there are people who might be from their tribe and they celebrate their tribe and it's not a big deal. Let's say your tribe is Bassa or Pele or whatever it may be, that you might have groups of people who are from that tribe. You have a community. Mm-hmm. You know, you still consider yourself Liberian. You still connect with people who are not necessarily from your tribe. But if your tribe does something, you show a sense of pride. So I think now there's a sense of pride across tribes. But I think that even though people may say that, you know, we celebrate all tribes, we're all the same, I think whenever there might be a disagreement between people, those issues that you thought was not an issue, it comes up to the surface. You know what I mean? Because it was never dealt with. So on the surface, it looks like it's not a problem. Tribes are great. We're from different tribes. You know, maybe I'm not American Liberian. It doesn't matter. We all one people. We're good. But then let there be an argument between the two of us. You know, maybe your tribe not from my tribe. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, you say that to me because we're not from the team tribe. You know what I mean? So it's I thought we were good. It's like, well, we are good. But whenever we have a disagreement, you fall back to, oh, you're looking down on me because my tribe is different. I'm from this place. You're looking down on me because I don't have the education you have. You know what I mean? So I think on the surface, it looks like everybody is okay. We all agree. We're fine. We're good. But I think sometimes when there's disagreement or misunderstanding or there's a hurt, I think those tribal lines bubble up to the surface in ways that maybe you thought everything was okay, it may not be okay, you know? So I guess the short answer would be honest. Now, I don't think you can say, oh, I'm not going to be friends with a person cutting from this tribe. I think everybody is just trying to just say, look, we all Liberians, let's work together.
Let's try.
But you can't just move past hurts like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
even though it may have been a long time ago,
yeah,
you're not just going to move past it and be okay. You know, yeah, it seems that way.
And I think from what I understand, the Charles Taylor reign or the Civil War was basically on ethnic lines. I think he was trying to revenge what was done to his ethnic group from the time of Samuel Doe. So I understand when you say the stuff about divisions and, you know, mm-hmm. it being deeply rooted. And just to say, it's not a unique situation in Liberia, because mm-hmm. a discussion mm-hmm. in South Sudan, even in Nigeria, it's all about the ethnic lines and the ethnic group.
Yeah.
And when it comes down to it, we are more likely to be loyal to our mm-hmm. ethnicity than to the nation as a whole. Mm-hmm. So
mm-hmm.
I guess it's just human behavior in that sense.
Yeah.
And so it's not, it's not particular to Liberia. And I was just going to say, like, we have to remember that the generation that is alive in places like Liberia, they are the ones that went through Samuel Doe and Charles Taylor's era, whereas you know, the newer generation, your kids, for instance, are more likely to be integrated with their friends from other tribes and things like that. Exactly. So it's just a matter of time.
Which is good, because we have a little bit of that in Nigeria, where the older generation kind of still remembers what happened with the war.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Versus our generation, we are kind of detached from that, so we don't see the that animosity.
Right. That is so true. And you have issues where people who are, I mean, like for us who left in the war, like you said, our children, we raised our children here. So we have a strong Liberian community in Atlanta. So my kids, you know, they hang around other, you know, plenty of other Liberians, but it's a different perspective because they are born here, you know, so it's a different perspective they have being Liberian here versus those of us who came here and have grown, but you still remember things from back home. It's different. It is different.
All right, let's make it a little bit more lighthearted. Helene kept talking about the Hartmen and the Nijis, and even when she was like a full grown adult, like, she kept referring to these kind of boogeymen that you had in Liberia. So and also in the book, there was a time that someone's dad was chased by a Hartman. So we wanted to ask you how real this was. What are Hartmen or Nijis? Are they real? Is it just a figment of children's imagination? What's the extent of their influence on the mythical?
Let me put it this way. I mean, it's a lot of it is storytelling. Mm-hmm. You can say it's story time, it's children's, you know, talk. But to me, you can have wickedness that can be wicked, but there's some bit of reality to it. Do you know what I'm saying? So it's rooted in the figment of your imagination. Some of it is pretend, but there were people that could do some wicked stuff. You don't want to be hanging around certain places late at night, you know? Because I think I remember right before we left, I left Liberia, there was some story about some men in the news who are considered, they call it hard man. You know, I mean, by the time it's turned to slang, it sounds like hard man, but somebody who is, you know, killing people, taking their hearts or their body parts to use for ritual, things like that. You know, so yeah, it's pretend in a way, but it's like there's other places you don't want to be late at night because anything can happen. Like I said, I remember right before we left, there was a story in the newspaper, even though I was, you know, 13 at the time, I do remember the story that I talked about some man who was allegedly a hard man, you know, that he could go around killing people and things like that. Some people say it's not true, but again, like I said, they say it's not true, but, you know, there's some truth to some of these things, you know.
Okay, so I guess it's similar to like juju or like witchcraft or charms and things like that.
Okay. Yeah, for the heart band. Like for the Nijis, I think that's more underwater, mommy water, things like
that. Oh, okay.
But for the heart band, it would be more, you know, people trying to kill you for you know, someone a ritualistic offering or something like that.
Okay. You know, so it's quite similar.
When I was reading this and they mentioned heartsmen and then Charles Taylor's army was described, like the soldiers wearing the wedding dresses.
Oh yeah. People are doing some crazy stuff, you know, because you have to imagine for some of these people who, and I have to just say this real quickly, for Charles Taylor, remember Charles Taylor has an American Liberian background. So he came with different intentions, you know what I mean? So it's not like you are just coming and saying, oh, I'm here to liberate indigenous people. You know, he has a background that has American Liberian in his background too.
But what was his problem? People,
Psycho.
So what was his problem?
That's a whole nother story for another conversation.
Yeah, true.
You know, but some of the people he came had not seen some of the things they had seen before. They had lived in isolated areas. So when they saw some of the things, when they were looting and robbing and killing and taking things from people, some of them just lost their mind. On top of the fact that he had them heavily drugged. Like he had a lot of them were on drugs and doing things to themselves that, you know, they were on drugs. So you got the fact that you got people, men, especially young men at the time, young boys who may have lived in isolated parts of the country and there's certain things they never saw. All of a sudden they have a gun, you got drugs in your system, you give it freedom, all of a sudden you're the person in charge and you end up doing all kinds of things that it's just crazy.
Especially you know? If you don't know better.
If you don't know better, you don't know better, you think that we're supposed to do, you got a little bit of power, you know, maybe last week you're just a little kid, your mom was saying you to go buy stuff at the market. This week, Charles Taylor and I come through. He got you in his army. He gave you drugs. He got a gun. You the main charge. You can do anything. You go to loot some other place. You see different things. Oh, I want it. I want to take this. I want it for myself. You know, you may not know what that thing even means because of where you lived before. But now, all of a sudden, you see stuff. Oh, yeah, I'm powerful. I want this for myself, you know. Yeah. So people are making just all kinds of choices. I mean, all kinds of things.
It's crazy because at the thick of the Civil War, I was telling Ugochi that the only thing I remember then about Liberia was the child soldiers. But as a child then, I really didn't understand the effects of that. But, you know, in school, we used to act plays and sing a lot of songs about Liberia and talk about the child soldiers and things like that. But it's only when you grow up that you're like, wow, yes, like, and then when Helene described it in the book, they were literally boys carrying guns and driving all around town. But yeah, the impact of that, I didn't feel that. I just knew we were acting plays in school about Liberia. And every time you mentioned Liberia, you mentioned child soldiers.
I mean, they were robbed. I mean, most of them were robbed of their innocence and their childhood, you know? Yeah. I mean, just a casualty in somebody else's, whatever reasoning he felt he was coming to do this to Liberia for, they were just swept away. It doesn't excuse them for the wickedness they did. They shouldn't have done it. But it's one of those things where you taking drugs, you got guns, you just don't know any better. You're just being used. You know?
I wonder, were these people rehabilitated? Was there like a mass rehabilitation scheme or everyone?
I know there was definitely attempts because, I mean, from some other books I read, there were definitely attempts.
Okay,
you know,
okay.
Give us, bring your gun. We'll try to do some counseling and things like that. So I know attempts were made to try to at least move forward for a place of peace. Mm-hmm. But, you know, truly, how can you really rehabilitate? You know what I mean? I mean, on a level of when that kind of thing happened and, you know, for the soldiers who did the wickedness, so the people who weren't soldiers but saw things. I mean, some of the things people have seen with killings. I mean, people would shoot a pregnant woman and not even think twice to shoot her and take the child out. I mean, you know, I don't want to get graphic on your podcast, but some of the atrocities, it was just unbelievable the wickedness people did, you know? And so I know there were attempts made at rehabilitation. There were attempts made, but you have to imagine on a whole, when you look at some struggles we have in Liberia today, you know, there has to be a connection between the struggles we had with the war and where we are now, you know, because even if you make attempts to counsel and do rehabilitation, I mean, it's just not, it's not like it was just one group of people or a small area. It was across the society, you know, that there's no one who can say that it has some impact from that war. In some, even though it may be different with the intensity, that there was an impact across the board, you know. And one thing I will throw out just about our education, before the war, Liberia had a really good educational system. I mean, it was probably known as, and not just because I'm Liberian, but I would say it was probably easily one of the best in West Africa, if not one of the best throughout Africa. I remember I had teachers from other countries who would come and teach because they wanted to be at the top of their game in Liberia. We had really good schools. And even when me and my siblings came here, we were able to we didn't have to be like two classes behind. We knew the things that most people in America knew. So I was in the 10th grade. I had just started the 10th grade. Mm-hmm. I was able to complete my studies in the 10th grade. They gave us different tests. And what we knew from being school back home was what most people here were learning anyway. So our education system was a very excellent education system. And now we look at our education system, it's not even the same. It's definitely a struggle. You have people who are trying to start schools to make impact. But when you look at across the board, the entire education system is just nowhere near where it used to be. I mean, it's just nowhere near, you know.
It's sad, like, to connect this to Afghanistan, the Taliban. So it was a lot of refugees from Afghanistan during that time of war in the 70s, I think, who came to Pakistan, and there were a lot of children. And so that's how, I guess, I think it was Osama bin Laden who created the Taliban, recruited children and indoctrinated them. And so I was watching the documentary, and this one woman said, this is a Taliban that you see today, is those children who are orphans, who don't value life because they grew up in this type of environment.
And that's why everyone is really afraid of Nigeria. Like, we have a population explosion, we have the most children out of school, we have like record numbers of people living in extreme poverty, and it's getting worse. Birth rates are remaining really high, especially in the north. There's going to be more trouble, especially with the young people, because I worked in a refugee camp, and just interacting with the refugee, they'll be like, I'm so angry of what like the Boko Haram people are doing to my family. I want to become a soldier so that I can carry out revenge. So you imagine that kind of boy is not educated. So from a soldier, if he gets into the wrong hands and he's given a gun, in his head he's a soldier, and he's just going to continue the fight in some other way. So that's why there's a real fear for countries like Nigeria. But
I tell you, I mean, we have so many resources, we have so much talent, so many good things, and you know, it's like we are in a position to really lead because we have so much talent. But young, you know, you can't neglect young children, you can't neglect lack, not having access to other things other people have access to, maybe not having education. Those things it's a tough recipe to put all that stuff together, you know. I mean, it's a tough one.
Slightly lighter note. We just wanted to understand, what's your connection with Liberia at the moment? And did you, Helene, were you ever ashamed? Did you go through that spell of, I want to dissociate myself with Liberia? And then maybe in another phase of your life, you said, oh, I'm now guilty, I was ashamed. So we wanted to understand like your relationship with being Liberian as a whole.
I don't think I was ever ashamed of being Liberian. I do know probably the toughest time was when we had first transitioned and what the people were saying. You know, I don't know if I was ashamed as much as I was just, it was just sad. You know, I don't know if I'll use the word shamed as much as they made you want to, they push you towards embracing your American side. So it's not like you embarrass them because you go home, you have your family and your house, so you can't be ashamed of it, but they make you because you just
hide it well.
When you come, you just want to just be in the, you just want to just assimilate in the culture. You don't really want to stand out. You don't want to be a part of the American society. You don't want to lay low. You don't want to stand out and do be flashy. So I guess in a sense, I don't consider being ashamed, but I guess you are hiding yourself because you don't want to wear African clothes to high school. You don't want to, you know, you don't want to stand out because the way they make you feel. You know, I mean, I think when you go home, you have your siblings, you guys are you know, eating the food, you cracking jokes, you got your own little Liberian in the house. But when you go back out into the school, you got people making you feel bad. You don't want to wear your, you know, you're not going to be doing your hand cornrows. You're not going to be wearing your African skirt and things like that. You're going to be trying to not show it to people. I will say it's funny. That's one difference I see with my children. And where I were at their age. Whereas for me, when we first came, because people will be saying things about being Liberian or you African booty scratcher and stuff like that, you don't wear your clothes. You don't probably put your culture on display as you would. You know, when I got to college, I hooked up with other Africans. I think I went through another phase where I was more willing to celebrate it, you know, than I was in high school. But my children, my daughters, I have a daughter who is in high school. She will wear African shirts on a regular, you know what I mean? But now it's a different season in America where people want to be wearing hair ties and, you know, expressing their heritage. You know, it's a different time, you know, where it's more celebrated, it's more, you know, people want to wear hair ties. People are looking for African cultural things. Whereas back in the 90s, people were not doing that. You know, people are wondering, why are you doing this and why are you doing that? Yeah. So I wouldn't say I was ashamed of, but I think from the war, we just kind of want to just lay low, just go to school.
Yeah.
You know, after having so many changes, we didn't want to rock the boat, just want to go to school, go do my work and come back to my house, you know, and that's all about it.
I think Helene's shame really came from the fact that her mom was raped by those soldiers.
Yes. Yes. Because that by itself, that's horrible by itself, you know, and then the way it happened, coming through the house with the soldiers, these are probably people they kind of look down on. So, you know, the power aspect of it, I mean, that was definitely an intense part of the book, you know, with that happened.
But how did that shame have anything to do with her life in Liberia? Are you trying to say that because that happened, she was trying to bury that Liberian side of her? Okay.
Because this is what her country had become, I guess.
Had become. Mm-hmm. Okay, okay. So for her, it was deeper than just, you know, weird African accent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that happened to make her shift it. So maybe if it hadn't happened, it might have been something different for her, you know, different terms.
Yeah. But do you visit Liberia now? Do you, like, still have family? Do you have ties with Liberia?
Oh, yes. I still have family there. In fact, my mother went there for about 6 weeks this summer. So she was there. She went there for 6 weeks. So I still have ties. I mean, I hope within the next year I can go visit. I'm not sure when I'll go, but I hope I can go. And I hope I can take my kids to go see it too. So I'm not sure when, but I hope to go and go see it. The last time I went was in 2016. I went with my sister in 2016. That was a really good trip. I mean, but before that point, I hadn't been there since 1990. So from 1990 to 2016, I had not been to Liberia. I went in 2016 for about 2 weeks.
Why did you go in 2016?
I went with my sister. She had some things to do there for her business. And so I went there to as an opportunity to just be a part of, to go see it, you know. And I was really glad I went to see it. I think it gave me a greater appreciation. I mean, the only reason I couldn't explain why I hadn't gone, it's just life had happened. You say you will go, you really don't go. And so I knew in 2016, if I didn't make an effort to go, who knows when I will go, you know? So I was really glad I went. I mean, I couldn't believe the number of people who are in Monrovia, because Monrovia is the, you know, the capital city. Mm-hmm. And when I left, there weren't as many people living there. But I think with the war, people have left the villages and are moving to look for opportunities in the city. But the city wasn't built to sustain that many people, you know. So it's a lot of it's a lot of people, a lot of traffic, a lot of stuff over there, you know, in the city. But it was a really good trip.
All right, so I have two more questions because I'm looking at the time. So the first one is, generally, what would you say you liked about the book? So, we'll start with you. Siata May, and then we can go around and just say something that intrigued us about the book.
I think what I like about the book was that I felt like she was writing from a segment of Liberians that I didn't know. I don't want to say I didn't know they existed, but that wasn't a life I could connect to. You know, I mean, we had a good life in Liberia. You know, we had my mom and my mom and my dad had a good job. We had a good life, but they were living on a whole nother level, you know, flying to Spain and all the different the money they had. And so I think I appreciated her book because it makes you, you know, I mean, I think Chimamanda Adichie talks about this, about just that story that there's no one Liberian story. There's no one Nigerian story. You know, here's somebody who went through the war in the coup in 1980, and her story would have been different from my part of the story in the war. You know what I mean? So it was almost like I appreciate the fact that I learned about people from my country that I didn't know that this was their lifestyle, some of the lifestyle she talked about, and having access to resources. And I felt like my family had a good life. I mean, I felt like our life was good. We had an enjoyable life. You know, I enjoyed our life in terms of access. It wasn't something where we didn't have access to things. My parents work hard, but to have a good life. But even as good as it was, here's somebody else in your country and they have access to things that you didn't even know was out there, you know? So I think I appreciated her sharing her story and things that I may not have known about, and how the coup impacted different people from different walks of life and different segments. I think for me, that's why we each need to tell our story, because you can have two people from Nigeria give a perspective of an event, and it's going to be two different. I mean, y'all will connect in terms of y'all being Nigerian, but depending on their status, they're going to have a completely different perspective from yours, you know? And so you can't just have one story be the sum of the country or one story be the sum of the nation.
That's why we need more stories. Multiples. Yeah, that's why we need more African stories out there.
You need more. We need more African stories. And not to assume, even for us from there, that this one Liberian book is that is everybody's experience in Liberia. Yes. It's not, you know? It's not. It's good to have that book out there, but we need other perspectives from Liberia, other perspectives from Nigeria to come forward, you know?
Yeah. Thank you for that. And Ugochi, what did you like about the book the most?
I think I like the history part, because I didn't know much about, I guess, how Liberia became a country.
Same here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed reading about Elijah Johnson. I think it was the founding father, right?
Yeah.
Who came, and how they kind of tried to negotiate land between Liberia and Sierra Leone, and how the natives rejected it. And it wasn't until they kind of strong armed them to acquire land, I guess, in modern day Liberia.
Yeah, I echo what you say as well. And why I like the book is that it was just an easy read. I mean, a lot of people criticize it because I think they thought she kind of played easily on really serious events, like when she was describing executions and her mom's rape. They thought she didn't really invoke the emotion that carried the weight. But I feel like, do you know what? This is someone's memoir. This is someone's story.
Right. You have to be careful, you know, how much she goes there, you know. I could tell, though, it's funny, because you could tell that she is a writer by training, because the way she was so methodical about the research and making sure we had a clear understanding, I did appreciate her back, you know, it was her story, but she took her time, and you could tell that this is not just someone who got up and said, let me write this story, that she really wanted to paint a clear picture for us to have a clear understanding.
Yeah.
Not just her story, but the greater story of how she arrived and where she was.
And she was quite vivid in describing the culture of Liberia, which is very, very similar to Nigeria. Like, you know, the funerals, the food. So it was quite nice. She even gave us a recipe at the end of the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do remember. Yeah.
Yeah, which is something like what my grandma would make. But yeah, it was quite nice. A nice, well-told family memoir kind of thing.
Yeah. Also described
Liberia's history. But saying that, I think the one part of the book I just felt like, you know, I really, really wish there was more push was describing Eunice and her role in all this, because I think, so by the end of the book, she tried to make it very central, Eunice's story very central, but I think the burning question for a reader would have been, how did Eunice really feel like being part of you guys, but still being an outsider? Surely, like, it could have, and I feel she didn't probe enough. What did you guys think?
I know for especially with 1990 with the war, I think that was something that was a sore spot, because you have this war, people are trying to get out. And so the people in your house that technically work for you, that you call your family, but you're not necessarily trying to make arrangements for them. You're trying to run out. You know, so we had a lot of different, probably hurts in different families, because all of a sudden you are, you know, the person is a part of the family, but now that y'all have to flee, everybody got to do what they got to do. You're not necessarily making plans for them. Mm-hmm. So I know that for some people felt left behind. Some people felt hurt. I think for some families, when they saw people who they had raised, kind of like, look, now it's my turn to rule you. I mean, you know, I'm going to be in charge now. It was like, wait, but you are part of the family, you know, but then I don't know. It's like, yes and no. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, I live in Liberia. We all upheld the system, but you look at someone, you see the person is your brother, your sister, but then when it's time to get out, you're not necessarily looking out for them, you know? So it's a touchy topic. And you know, because you call them family, it's very sensitive.
Yeah, and as you said, people have different reactions. Not everybody is going to have that, oh my God, you know, deep reaction. Eunice was probably just grateful for what she got, and when she didn't have it, she learned to do without. Like, she really, she seemed really happy at the end, which was very positive. But I think for a long time, I was wondering, why is she happy when, like, you know, this family abandoned her? But everybody has their threshold, not their threshold, but their level of how they measure happiness, and that should be
Yeah,
I know you have to leave soon. Do you want to maybe plug any of your projects that you are currently working on?
Yes, thank you for the opportunity. I wish there was a way for us to continue, though, because it's been a good discussion. It's been a really good discussion. I appreciate y'all giving the platform just for African stories, because you know, we've shared that it's necessary to have it, and I appreciate you for making space for that. For me, things I'm working on, I have a short story that I'm working on that I'll probably announce on my Instagram page, and my Instagram page is Lapa Stories. So there's a short story I'm working on, and I'm hoping to, my Lapa Stories Instagram community is also a book community. So I read a book a month. It's I would probably say 60% of the time is by African writer, but sometimes it may be by African American writer. Okay. I'm hoping to at some point get on YouTube and maybe share my reviews on YouTube. So that's something I'm working on, rolling out book reviews on YouTube and a short story. And the short story will definitely be an African short story. So that's my lane, and that's what I write about. So I'm hoping to do both of those things, you know, within the next month or so.
Awesome.
All right. Well, we just want to say a big thank you for joining us and being flexible as well with our time schedule. This has been an amazing time talking to you. Ugochi, did you want to say something?
Oh, a huge thank you. This has been great. I do wish that thank we could you. Talk more, because there's so
I
much.
I know.
but it's been great.
But
well,
I tell you what though, if you guys ever reviewed, you know, and it may not be me because there's probably other people, but if y'all down the road, cycle back to Liberia, a great book is Wiatu's Moor, The Dragon, The Giant, and the Women. And she really shares her experience with the war, you know, and the impact of the war on her as a writer. She's written, there's another book she wrote before too. I think She Would Be King was a book she wrote before this one. But this one is a memoir specifically of the 1990 war and how she and her family had to leave suddenly. They were separated from her mom, you know, and I think she wrote it, if it wasn't a year ago, it may have been a year or two ago, I can't remember, but that's a good book. You know, The House of Sugar Beach really focuses on the coup. I mean, you know, she talks about the war, but it's mostly on the 1980 coup. This is a good follow-up to see the fallout of 1990 with the war. And again, it's Wiatu Moore. She's a writer. So I'll her find it. It's a different, but it's a very good read, a very, very good read. So.
Thank you so much, Siata May. No problem.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Gucci and Amara. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, so to our lovely audience, we appreciate your support in continuing this journey with us. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, and follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. All three of our platforms is called AfroReads Podcast. If you happen to read the book, please discuss it, share your thoughts, opinions, and questions about it on our platforms. Our book up next is Period Pains by Kopano Matlwa, taking you all the way to South Africa. So we look forward to you joining us on the next episode. Till then, take care and have a blessed week.